Blog Talk Radio.
Horror enthusiasts and fans of things that go bump in the night, rejoice, as there is a new collection of creepy tales to keep your spine tingling and your blood running cold. The brainchild of prolific author Yvonne Mason. Welcome to Your Nightmare is an anthology of stories from a gifted batch of writers specializing in keeping you up at night. Whether you love gruesome tales of murder and mayhem, or you prefer quaint tales of scary happenings, welcome to Your Nightmare, sure to please the inner psychopath and whet even the most insatiable horror appetite. Welcome to Your Nightmare is available now on Amazon.com.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. It is Wednesday night, and if it's Wednesday night, this is Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason. That was my friend and ad man, Christopher Dunham, and he just brought to life another ad for me for my anthology, Welcome to Your Nightmare. I had over 32 published authors and new authors and some who had never been published who wanted to do an anthology with me. So we created two books, and one of them is Welcome to Your Nightmare. Also in that book is a story by the one and only Nicholas Grabowski, who has been around for a long, long time. The man is just, he is the guru of the publishing industry and the writing horror industry. So go and pick that book up and find some new writers, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. As I am wont to do every morning, because that is my nature, I run my numbers for this show because I'm very proud of this show. I'm proud of the people that come on this show, the authors, the musicians, the business people, the platform people, the people that just want to talk. Because we all are dreamers, and the world is made up of dreamers. And because of this show, there are dreamers who are getting recognized and learned about and heard from in over 53 countries. This show touches 53 countries. This morning, just on this show, just on Blog Talk Radio, we're at 6,447 listeners, with the highest listening base in Australia, and I have to give them a shout-out every night because I am so grateful to the land down under. They are very faithful. They're even more faithful than the good old USA. And when we include all of the podcasts that this thing goes up on after it goes into archives, our reach is 14,889 listeners. We are 111 listeners away from the 15,000 listener goal that I had in mind when I started this thing. So I want to give a shout-out to everyone that listens to this show live or on the podcast or in archives. I appreciate every one of you. I am very humbled and honored that you spend an hour with us and listen to the show and learn things about people you might not learn about, because as indie artists, it's very difficult for us to get out there. And if you don't know we're out there, then you won't read us or listen to us or look at our art. So I am very grateful to every single one of you, and I thank you. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I have a return author come to visit, and every time this gentleman and I get on the phone, it's instant connection, because this man is so literature smart and so amazing to talk to, and I just want to soak up everything he says like a sponge. If I lived in the Baltimore area, I would go take writing from this man, even though I've been published for years. I would sit in his class and let him critique me and let him do critical analysis and let him do constructive criticism on my work until the cows come home, because I am just so honored that this man agrees to come on this show time after time. He's phenomenal. His name is David Hoof, and he is a critically praised international best-selling fiction author. He is a writing teacher, and he lives in Washington, D.C. He has critical appraisal, including citations for skill in enhancing an invocative language, is given on the homepage, and he's honorable mention 2009 Beach Book Festival, 2009 Reader Circle Choice. He's been nominated for Book Six Piece. The man is just phenomenal. And every time we talk, we run out of time before we run out of subject matter. So with that, I'm not wasting any more of our hour, and I'm going to say welcome, David, and I am so glad you're here again tonight.
Thank you, Vaughn. I'm pleased to be here, and I'm delighted that you have a lot of fans in what the minute work called the Lindy and Linda, which is Australia.
I love it.
An old Mike of mine called Max Humphreys, who's living in Sydney with a wife who's an American wife who also went to Cornell, and we saw them in the 2000 Olympic Games down there. These are wonderful people. If you have them for listeners, they are just the most congenial people that one can imagine, and I'm delighted that some of them are out there at Ayers Rock.
I'm blown over. 78% of the listening base for Blog Talk Radio is out of Australia.
And as I said, these are terrific people, and they've got a wonderful sense of self, and I've interacted with people at CSIRO, which is the Australian equivalent of our National Science Foundation. They are our top drawer scientists, and again, the aspect of intrigue or intellectual curiosity is not alien to these people. It's a wonderful attribute, as is their congeniality. If you have a chance, make the trip.
It's on my bucket list. I may be 100 years old, but I do want to go to Australia. There's so much history there. Just to be able to go to Australia and just soak up the history of how it was settled and why it was settled and all of the history that goes with it, I can't get enough of it.
Yeah.
And for Robert, them to honor me with this, it's amazing.
Yeah, recommended reading for those of you who haven't had it is Robert Hughes' book, The Fatal Shore, which traces the history of Australia and is good reading as well. Much recommended.
I will get that. Now, before the show, you and I, as we are wont to do when we are together, we're talking about one of our favorite classic literature writers who was not very well received when he was alive and writing, and it took his death in 400 and something years for him to
453.
Really,
yeah, 453.
There you go. For him to come to the surface. And ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about William Shakespeare. David, what is today?
Today is the 453rd anniversary of his baptism. Records were poorly kept in England at the time. The only thing that prompted the initiation to keep records was the Black Plague, which hit Europe in 1349, came into Genoa on a plague ship. From that time forward, it became a recurrent wave to the extent that Europe set upon whom you believe between a third and a half casualty of their population. When Shakespeare was born in Stratford-upon-Avon, the infants beside him in his house, either side, perished from the plague. Shakespeare did not. That was a random bit of luck. What one has to do is imagine, what if this infant had not survived? Where would we be in terms of our world? Geniuses only come every 400 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're looking at the consequences for fatality, it's a wonderful what-if game to play, which authors need to play. All authors need to play.
So if one of the two other children had not perished and Shakespeare had,
yes,
we would not have had the literature that he penned that has survived wars and everything else.
Yep. Much to the credit of his friends, the friends who, in fact, assembled the first folio, because in entertainment art, which it was of the day, these were considered dramatizations. They were performed at the Globe. There were at least two events in Shakespeare's life which profoundly influenced the man. The one was the accidental fire at the Globe, which burned down, and the other was the death of his son Hamnet, which has a strange connection with the word Hamlet. And if you look at his tragedies, you'll find that in several of them, like Romeo and Juliet, number one, and Hamlet specifically, being similar to Hamnet, that there is at least a subplot in both of these works of literature in which a child or a young person is unable to establish their hopes and their eventual career because they die prematurely. In Romeo and Juliet, both of the lovers, in Hamlet at the end of the play, these are unrealized potential. And more than anything else in Hamlet's life, he had two children. He had Hamnet and he had Judith, a son and a daughter. But Hamlet died prematurely, and Shakespeare, in terms of the influence on his writing, he was a person just like you or me. And he manifested his feelings in his writing to an extent that seems both inevitable and, from a critical point of view, perhaps avoidable. But nonetheless, if we are unable to express our own feelings profoundly and eloquently, we have denied reader a full emotional access to not only who we are, but what the world is in which we live.
And that's a very good point. Yeah. That is an extremely good point, because even writers that say, I don't put any of myself in my book, they lie. We can't help but put some of who we are in a book.
Terrific and on point. It is the way in which we communicate our feelings to the characters and the way that extends to them the permission to be themselves. It is a matter of communicating what we profoundly feel in terms of our characters in a way that respects, nonetheless, their individuality. These characters are not puppets. They are real people. And you would be surprised the number of authors, including more recently here in D.C., Don DeLillo, who was obsessed about what he wanted to do in terms of expression of himself and his imagination of the world, rather than extending permission to explore a set of character sensibilities when exposed to a certain set of threats or opportunities, which is the way, and if I want to be more specific, I have a book called A Death in Munich where I entered into it. It's set in 1931 in Nazi Germany, coming up, and it deals with espionage in the time, and I had in mind a woman character who would play the kind of role that a woman might in 1931 Germany, only to have her surprise me with this iron fist and the velvet glove, and in a sense take over the story because of her social facility. She knew what opportunities exist. She was a perfect social tuning fork and understood what opportunities resonated in the moment. And God bless her, and God bless me, that she became what she was. How could I do that as a man? I've got two daughters. I've got a loving wife, so I'm surrounded by women who insist on making their impression on me. And it's been a godsend because it's opened up a whole world of views and opportunities. But as I said in beginning the novel, I never had a really, and George Higgins has said this as well, that one never knows at beginning a novel the entire range or emotional opportunity that a character presents. What you have to do is extend them permission to be themselves and then be honest enough to recognize what they will do or not do in a circumstance. And if one can do that, you are the respectful. Ibaban, you talked later about not allowing themselves into the novel. That would be ideal. But to the extent that our emotional involvement allows us to avoid making our characters puppets in a predetermined scheme, that may be... go ahead, Ibaban, sorry.
No, finish your thought.
No, I simply said to avoid creating extensions or projections of ourselves, to allow these people to be, to the extent that you know your circle of friends, that they will be or be what they are, and this is an expression of themselves, and there are certain things that they will either reveal or not reveal, depending upon the confidence that they hold for you at that time.
And if we force that character, then that character comes out being one-dimensional.
Indeed they do. One might say, Ibaban, wooden in that respect. And the wooden extends to the idea of puppets dancing at the end of a string. I would suggest that readers want to be as honestly surprised by the character's reaction at some point in the story as the author is to be surprised by the character doing it. At that point, I genuinely think you've broken through one's own limitations and broken through to the real potential of the premise of the story itself.
Yeah, nothing is more fun than when I'm sitting there typing and writing all this dialogue back and forth, and then all of a sudden I stop and I go back and read it and I say, where did that come from?
Yeah.
That wasn't even on my radar.
As I said, these things are discoveries, and it's part of the reward of the creative process, and anyone who's written to any extent seriously is aware that the treasures that come from these discoveries are part of the reward. Forget financial rewards entirely. I've said to my students at Georgetown, I just got a check from my universe for $1.23 for a novel that I wrote in 2005, and it's kind of nice to know that they're still keeping track, but that's not the reason I write.
We write because we can't help ourselves, David. Don't you agree? And I would go even more insane than I already am.
I think the idea is Ibaban, that it is emotionally rewarding to do this. And I'll tell you a little secret here that I've told certain people, but not a lot. There was a guy when I was studying English at Cornell, named Douglas Abercrombie, was a professor. And he said to me at the time, and this is long, long ago, this is 45 years ago, if there's anything you do in this life, the one thing you shouldn't do is write novels. Let's be kind to Douglas Abercrombie, that from his perspective, he honestly believed this. This was his evaluation, and I think that it was an advantage to have that resistance put up. But I wasn't writing novels for Douglas Abercrombie. I wasn't necessarily writing them for me. I was writing them to discover the potential of this medium. And each time that I did, and I transcended the projection of my own predisposition onto the page, I drew a bit. And the
idea—that is a great way to look at it.
The rewards are in doing it. If one gets in there and says, and God knows I'm in the position to be both rich or poor. I've come in with something like $750,000 from sight unseen in terms of the Japanese royalties, Japanese language royalties. Don't ask me why. Why is the unanswerable question in this business? Nonetheless, it is. Ain't that great? But the fact that it didn't happen again is not the reason that I continue to write. Nor should it be for anyone. One can sort of imagine an old geezer with a quill pen someplace in a cobwebby attic of a castle scratching away on his story. God bless him if it rewards him. It serves a purpose.
And that brings us back to Shakespeare, because I think, humbly thinking, Shakespeare wrote because he had to.
Mm-hmm. He did. It was his way of ascending, and there is little debate now among serious scholars that you're looking at a person who created his own meritocracy, that he ascended the common standard. If one looks at, for instance, Hamlet, depending upon whom you believe, it may have been the seventh independent version of that story, or the 13th. Well, split the difference and call it 10. It was nothing original. There were only two original plays in Shakespeare, as nearly as anyone can get. That is to say, material that had not been rendered previously in some form. And those were Midsummer Night's Dream, number one, and The Tempest, number two. These appear to have been, if you will, dream creations, not necessarily unconnected. If you look at The Tempest, it certainly involved the awareness of the new world. The line, "O brave new world," that has such people in it, is a direct reflection of the fact that 1492, there was a discovery of America. That's midway in Shakespeare's lifetime. It was before The Tempest was written. And it's logical to connect to that. So there was this awareness of this person. And it could have been a man, it could have been a woman. We look back at women authors, and we can go back to the first written novel in Babylonia. And I forget, this was a tremendously independent woman. And it came out of the series on women that's been narrated by a British historian and archaeologist at this point, pointing out that the first written epic that we had was authored by a woman. It was authored by a woman in that situation because she had moved herself into a political position that enabled her to write that. But it is a phenomenal testimony to the determination of expression of women, even when they couldn't call themselves women like George Sands, to go out and explore this medium. And God bless them. We've been much richer for their contributions, yours included, Yvonne.
Well, thank you, my friend. I'm honored. Like I said at the beginning of the show, if I lived in your area, I would find a way to come and be in your class to learn from you, because if I'd had you when I was in school as an English teacher or as a literature teacher or a creative writing teacher, I would be so much richer for it.
Well, I hope you would be so much more liberate in that respect. I look at a number of the structure of a number of fine arts programs, in Master of Fine Arts in English, including the one at Iowa, which is famous, and Vonnegut taught in that workshop. And nonetheless, they become experienced in savaging the other students and trying to test their mettle and see if it's almost like a SEALS program, Navy SEALS program. And that isn't necessary. The idea is, in going in and looking at student work, is an attempt to discover something they genuinely do well, whether it's descriptive writing or whether it's merely the expression and cadence of the language, and then getting them to focus on that one asset and to build on that asset. I don't know any author writing or wanting to write who doesn't depend upon their strength. It could be dialogue, it could be characters, it could be story structure, it could be mood, it could be a sense of place. These are their strengths. P.D. James, for instance, the English mystery writer, has a phenomenal ability to portray or almost immerse the writer in the sense of place. And she doesn't avoid that. What she needs to do, what she does do, but what she needs to work on doing is developing the characters themselves and other things. So we all play to our strength in growing as a writer, what we need to do. It's almost like a tennis player. If they have a great forehand, as long as your opponent delivers to your forehand, you're going to do wonderfully. But when they hit a shot that requires you to play a backhand, it's like Chris Everett. You've got to learn to play the backhand.
Well, I tell you, I learn so much from you every time we talk.
Oh, I think, yeah, go ahead.
I go back and I use it.
Yeah. Well, that's the hope. The writer goes back and is able to muster the advice in a way that serves themselves. At the end of each course, I say to the writers, if you've heard nothing that helps you and everything you can remember runs against your sensibilities, then forget all this and launch out on your own, because at the very least you need to maintain your confidence. I did have a contract in New York from Bernard Geis, who paid me $1,000 for a story premise and then $1,000 more for the first three chapters. After we finished that, we reached the point where it was clear that my rendering of the story was not connecting with his imagination of what the story could be. Since I understood that I could not write under his emotional guidance because I couldn't internalize it, we terminated the relationship and went our way. But it was a valuable lesson, and that for him to say, write my story, was something that was inaccessible to me. Couldn't do it. I don't know that anyone can do it. It is almost a betrayal to oneself. But I want you to attempt to understand the sense of isolation that a writer could have in being asked to write from somebody else's imagination.
It's almost impossible. You can't, because you're not in that person's mind. And as much as they verbalize their storyline and plotline, it's impossible because you don't know what they're thinking.
Point taken. And I think that the idea of the writer being unforthcoming to the imagination of another person may be antithetical to the creative process itself. Just a suggestion.
We don't hear the voices in their head. We hear the voices in our head, and the voices in our head may not be saying the same thing as the voices in their head.
I think that's aptly put, and it is less a matter of disparaging the individual and their vision of a story than of understanding that another one cannot accommodate that. It's not to say that their vision of the story was incorrect or would have been ineffective. It's just a matter that an individual who is sufficiently disparate in imagination from this other character can't carry. It would cause, Yvonne, should you be asked to do it, it would cause you endless anxiety and a sense of And I'm just projecting my own, a sense of failure where there's no failure that then necessarily can be attached to it. It was one of those disconnects that is almost inevitable in the entertainment business.
Because I go back to the premise, if two people watch a train wreck, they're witness to a train wreck, you're going to get two different perspectives.
Yeah. And it's a wonderful point and well taken. And that comes to, for instance, in mysteries, if you're ever writing them, that my lawyer friend Steve Clark, who's a wonderful guy, had said, there's nothing more convincing to a jury than eyewitness testimony. At the same time, there's nothing necessarily less accurate than eyewitness testimony. And if you look at the Innocence Project.
That is very true. Because if the prosecution and the defense can cross-examine the same witness and get two different, not two different stories, but two different perspectives.
Yeah.
And that's the same in reading a book. You and I can read the same book and get two different perspectives out of the same book, and neither perspective is wrong. We just see it.
My hope is, yes, that the author is good. The people, in fact, will get disparate perspectives on that. If you look at the book club experience, if you take the identical book, very same text, and 12 people in that, you're likely to get a rather heated disagreement of people as to what it means or not. I will never forget a lecture that I heard by a Nobel Prize winner, Nadine Gordimer, at the Smithsonian, and there was an interviewer who was a woman author from the Washington Post, and opened up by telling Nadine Gordimer what it was that her novel meant. And Nadine Gordimer took a beat. She paused about a beat and a half, and then she said in her own way, "Wherever did you get the idea that that's what I meant?"
Okay.
This wonderful. The reason that it was so refreshing is the candor and the failure both of the individual who read it to insist on their own interpretation, and the failure of the author, however well celebrated, to understand that if she really delivers this story to her readers, then each of these readers is going to create his or her own story as they read it. If you do that, you've succeeded. If you try to lecture, a la Michener, for instance, that this is the only way, and since the world began, this is the way to sit back and enjoy it, then there's a certain tyranny in that.
And it also takes the joy out of learning what's in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that readers come to a work of fiction with the idea of being lectured or having the author moralize. I think that the expectation is that the author, as nearly as their abilities allow, presents the fictional world to the reader with the trust that, this is a confidence, it's almost a sacred confidence, that the reader will see, and very often, Yvonne, the reader will see something that was there in a work that is actually there, but I didn't recognize it when I wrote the book. They're not wrong. Their antenna is simply more creatively astute than my awareness was when I wrote the book. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes perfect sense. I was going to reiterate that with when my sister and I were younger, my mother read Pilgrim's Progress, and when my sister would come home from school, she would sit under my mother's ironing board, and while my mother was ironing, she would tell my sister about Pilgrim on his progress, and she would explain to her all the things that she learned from the book and how she translated it, and then my sister goes away to Harding College. Well, they have to read Pilgrim's Progress in a literature class, and she calls my mother up and says, "Mother, the way my professor explains this book is not like you explained it to me when I was a little girl. He said it didn't mean that thing." Again, perception.
There is, Yvonne, this business. And if specifically, if you look at the range of interpretations literarily for Moby Dick, you will find a range of evaluations of the work that are necessarily contradictory to one another. And it has been said, and I would offer to you with some degree of validity, that the criticism of a literary work reveals more about the mind of the critic than it does the nature of the work itself.
Thank you for saying that out loud. Because I've had authors come to me almost in tears going, so-and-so said so-and-so about my book, yada, yada, and I'm saying, wait, that's not on you. That is on them because, number one, they went into the book with an expectation that when they didn't think it was met, it was a bad work. It doesn't make it a bad work. It makes the fact they didn't read it with an open mind.
Yes, in fact, selective reading is a wonderful source of skewed criticism, and it can be broken down almost scientifically into a process where the author, where the critic to his or her credit, does properly cite the work, but avoiding those aspects from the work which exist yet are contrary to his or her interpretation. And that's critical. One of the obligations in science or evaluation is that you fairly represent the totality of the work. And if the critic encumbers himself or herself with this obligation and fairly addresses it, then you can have reasonable confidence that there is a balanced view of that. But in the absence of that confidence, you're going to end up with some kind of skewed perception.
And that is sad because the reading public generally misses out on a lot of works when they skew their mentality of reading. And when they assume that they know what the author was thinking, instead of just saying, well, this is what I got out of it, this was my interpretation. Well, the author should have thought this, and the author should have done that. Well, how do you know that? What makes you the expert on the author's state of mind?
This is, I think, the idea is whether the author is didactic or expository or whether the author is far more subtle about that. I recommend to my writers for their consideration, not necessarily as being the only way of looking at it, but presenting the world to the reader in the way that they, the reader, are familiar with encountering the world. So if a character engages the world of the story in terms of sight, sound, smell, tactile encounters, feel, and taste, then the reader is going to say, this is the world in which I live. If, on the other hand, the reader presents the world with a sensation only, for instance, for the visual, there is necessarily a flatness to that presentation that doesn't engage the world in a multisensual way. To go beyond all the five senses, one might also say that a reader is engaged, is aware of in their lives, whether they're hot, whether they're cold, whether they're comfortable in a social situation, whether they're feeling awkward. And all of these dimensions need to be presented to the story in order for the reader to be convinced that this is a possible reality, that they're joining this experience. I talk about the authors who are exclusive. That is to say, if you look at a novel like The Coup, for instance, by John Updike, who no doubt is an erudite man and a superb superb writer. The first chapter opens with what is 85% prologue, and this is Updike standing on the podium behind the lectern telling the author about the story world. I would much prefer if he simply took a character and immersed me in that world so I could join the character rather than be lectured at. Maybe a personal preference, but this is up for grabs. Your reaction to that?
If a prologue starts out with somebody giving a lecture, I probably would get bored with it very quickly.
And you're quite entitled to it, Lon. That was my point. To take the reader for granted may be the greatest authorial sin.
Absolutely.
It's an act of, to me, egotism and hubris. And what the reader needs to know is that the writer accepts them as a partner in this shared experience. That's
a
hope,
true.
Anyway.
Well, and the hope is to bring that reader into the story to either be an active participant or someone who's watching it unfold like a movie, and they're surrounded in surround sound by this story, and when they're finished with the book, they feel all the emotions of the story, and they're exhausted.
I would say yes. The degree of emotional involvement is essential. If the novel becomes a victim of what critics justifiably call expository lumps, L. Zuckerman, whom I've met, is the creator of Writer's House in New York, and he said in best-selling fiction, readers want two things. They want an experience to which they would otherwise not have access, and they want characters who are sufficiently like themselves that they can feel are real and empathetic. You do that, you can go any place with those two factors.
Case in point, my mother and my husband both like the Jack Reacher series. Neither one of them can wait to get their hands on Lee Child's books because Reacher has become real to my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes on every journey with him, and when she's through with the book, she has all these emotions, and she has to call me up and talk about what he's been doing and why he's been doing it, and it's like she's got to get it all out of her system so that she can go to another book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can understand that reaction. Often I come to a story not with the premise of the superhero, but with the antithesis of the person who is less socially desirable and has to survive and mature. I have one idea unrealized yet, and if it's real, I'm committing the prime sin of a writer, and that is to mention the premise of the story over a public medium, because somebody will grab it for God bless you if you can do it. Go ahead and do it. I don't know that I'll ever get to it. But the premise is a normal high school in the United States where there is a guy who is socially stigmatized, and he has become not Jack Reacher, but the Bleacher Creature. And the Bleacher Creature is somebody who sits up all by themselves. He attends every football game. He tries to, and he's a reasonable kind of guy, but he's socially awkward and he might have bad skin. But inside, the basis for this is Joseph Merrick, who is the Elephant Man, and a thoroughly delightful human being. But cursed by these two diseases, Proteus syndrome and neurofibromatosis, they've determined from his skeleton that he was the winner of the double negative lottery. He got these genetic inflections in a way that if you were a fair person statistically, you'd say, no way is anyone going to ever suffer one of these, let alone both of them. But the idea is that you can be in high school, God knows, kids are cruel this time. A perfectly pleasant, acceptable person yearning to make a connection and doing all the right things, including attending the football games and the basketball games. But everyone stigmatizes you. They move away from you, and therefore Bleacher Creature. This is the name he has, and it's a bit like the Patrick Dempsey movie Can't Buy Me Love. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but
yes.
He was a kid. Yeah, but you get the notion. This is mm-hmm. not original, but none of Shakespeare, except for The Tempest and A Midsummer Night's Dream, none of Shakespeare was original. It's the way, it's not the story itself in concept, it's the way that the writer renders the story.
I One think version, you should write it.
Yeah. Well,
I think you should. The thing is,
it's an attractive story. You can think of something like a guy like Charles Martin Smith in American Graffiti, who played this character Toad,
mm-hmm.
who was perfectly likable on his own terms, and he fit. His role in terms of where he fit in the hierarchy was for everybody else to have fun with or make fun of, and yet these people are yearning for the same thing that you or I or anyone else would yearn for. And that's what makes them appealing, is that you don't know anyone who hasn't felt in their life a sense of being less popular, less in touch, or or having less achievement than the other person. These are appealing sorts of characters because they touch the inner apprehensions of anyone who's gone, who I might say is an escapee from this stigma. Everyone can touch this because they feel it, they felt it, whether or not they were stigmatized by their fellow students.
And whether or not they ever openly announced it later on in life, you know, sometimes they kept it close to their vest because they didn't want to bring it up for fear it would happen again.
A wonderful point, and there is an inner persona of the individual. If people have been the prom queen or the quarterback of the football team, then they come out with this sense of accomplishment, which lays down unrealistic expectations as they ascend in the world. And the attitude which attends these expectations is often one which acts contrary to their ambitions. Again, the beauty of a character like Bleacher Creature is that he is able to console somebody who has had a great defeat on the homecoming football game, because he knows what it's there to be. To be that character. It's a premise for a story which will remain attractive whether or not I go to it or not. And this is the thing, Yvonne, with you, you're my simpatico, as another writer said. The reason for writing the book is that it makes a connection with the reader, not because it's going to go out and compete with Jack Reacher, but because on its own terms, it's valid and it's closer to the experience of many readers than Reacher's adventures.
And that, I was just sitting here thinking again of Shakespeare, and that's what, if one reads Shakespeare in its purest form, one also understands that's what Shakespeare did. He reached out to horror and love and witchcraft and human nature
yep.
and expectations and failures and strengths and weaknesses and betrayals and...
Yeah, the wonderful reach of characters in the Shakespeare presented the characters and allowed them to determine their own destiny. A guy like Falstaff, who was commanded by Queen Elizabeth to make a repeat performance. Had it not been for Henry V, there would never have been a Falstaff in the Merry Lives by the Queen of England. And this kind of character, which lives in the imagination of your readers beyond an initial performance, is at the back, I would argue, of every series novel that's being written today.
I agree.
If there were not legs in this character or a future and the character themselves, there would be no sequel, no part two, part three, part four. The problem, Yvonne, if I might pick up and suggest this, is that in characters, in the novels of John Sanford, who's done a wonderful job initially with the Prey series, is that Lucas Davenport, whom is his primary detective, does begin to age, and he does recognize as his series progresses that Lucas has had former injuries and this sort of thing. The thing that series failed to recognize most astutely is, or more astutely, is the human experience. If Lucas Davenport, at the beginning of his career, can run 10.800 meters, 10 years later, no matter who you are, your prime, you're not going to be able to run at 10.800 meters.
You're probably not going to be able to run 50 meters in 10.8.
Yeah, we could end the program on that, Yvonne. That's phenomenal compression of what I was getting to. But if one takes a series characters, if there is any physical exertion involved, if there is even something as modest as a character progressing 15 years into what would be the senior years, say from 35 to 50. There is a difference in the way that character, as a machismo male private eye, would be able to hold a pistol steadily.
Yes.
By
and,
50.
And as smart as readers are, if he tried to make that character do what he did 10 years ago,
the
reader
not,
would know it.
It strains credibility. Many people don't do simple numbers. What do I mean by that? If a character is supposed to have been 35 years of age at the time of JFK's assassination, if he's around looking into it 15 years later, he's going to be 50 years old and have all of the calculations, expectations, disappointments of a 50-year-old, that the characters age beyond the story. The one, I would say the temptation to do that, it's a cartoon, Yvonne, forgive me, but Popeye is always Popeye. And because he's a cartoon character, he can afford to be ageless. Once you bring a character out of the cartoon world and say he's subject to the same processes as you or me, then suddenly you have a difficult kind of predicament. Wonderfully
and
done, by the way. Yeah, go ahead, please.
And if you don't age him out, then I think you do the story itself an injustice.
Indeed, one does. There is a richness, an opportunity for richness in character. If a character, as they age, does not compensate for former assets with assets that are acquired later, like social skills and balance and understanding of the human condition, there are opportunities for these narratives between writer and reader where the character, the lead character, can become for the reader a model or at least a mirror to their own life. I've written a book which is coming out in June called Death Makes No Deals, and it, they say, with, for whom does it Is it written for everyone who likes that kind of thing? Whom does it deal with? A person who's involved, who is evolved to their 62nd year and comes to reflect on their life as it is and was presented to it. So we have a character with a past who has to live with the past, who has to live with the choices they made and the losses that they've suffered. And this is, to me, what makes the character attractive, is he's durable. But if you look at him in a younger version, you have Smilla Jasperson from Peter Hoag's marvelous novel, Smilla's Sense of Snow. This is not a woman who is terribly attractive in terms of being engaging to the opposite sense. That's not the way she defines herself. Yet she is an admirable character, determined, well-founded within her own experience, justifiable in her reactions to that, and admirable in the fact that she's unwilling to be compromised and cowed. So if one looks, one says, gee, I don't want to write a character who is agreeable and who is pleasant and knows anyone, look at Smilla Jasperson. She's none of these things and yet is riveting in terms of being engaging. Again, I don't know if you've read the novel but or seen the movie, but it's a phenomenal character.
Well, guess what, David? I'm going to have to bring you back in September because we're getting ready to run out of time.
Okay. Well, again, all games end as long as I make it. Yvonne, this has been a delightful engagement. I thank you so much for the pleasure of your
thank
company.
Thank you. Like I said, I could sit and listen to you for hours and learn so much. Would you be willing to come back in September?
I would. As I said, you've intrigued me by your Australian contingent because I absolutely love the people. And if they're out there listening, hi. Oi,
well,
mate. Oi, Aussie.
Oi. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I will bring David back and we will continue this conversation because we are fixing to lose our hour here. It has flown by. The man has got so much knowledge, and I'm just so honored that he is willing to spend an hour with me. And go out and get his books, ladies and gentlemen. He's got the new one coming out, Death Makes No Deals, A Death in Munich, The Sharpshooter, Triple Jeopardy, Little God, Sight Unseen, and The Last Prisoner. Those are the ones that I have written down. Please go and order David's books. You will not be sorry. The man is just, I can't say it enough. He's a phenomenal author, he's a phenomenal teacher, and he's a phenomenal human being. And I say that with the utmost sincerity, and I am so honored every time that he agrees to come on my show.
Well, Yvonne, thank you so much.
You're welcome, my dear. Tomorrow night, Billy Wade, Storm Chaser, will be here. We will learn things, so be here at 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time to listen to Billy Wade as he tells us why he goes and chases storms. And ladies and gentlemen, you know at the end of every show, this is what I say. If you want to achieve greatness, stop asking permission. And I also say this, your smile is your logo. Your personality is your business card. How you leave others feeling after having an experience with you, that, ladies and gentlemen, becomes your trademark. And understand this. If you were parents, if you were aunts, if you were uncles, and there's some wee ones about you, and those wee ones have dreams, do not be remiss in supporting those wee ones' dreams. Because they are our future, ladies and gentlemen. They are the ones that will be the dreamers and be the inventors, the musicians, the artists, the painters, the writers. Help them achieve their dream because they can. It is very important that they achieve their dream because without them, we have no future. Take care of them, love them, protect them, and take really good care of them, because without them, we're lost. So until tomorrow night, ladies and gentlemen, remember this, dream big or go home. Join us at 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. with storm chaser Billy Wade. David, hang on just a second.
Yes, of course.
The show is now going into archives, but I did want to tell you that when this thing goes up into archives, I'm going to put it on my page and I'm going to tag you in it. Please share it with others because you are so, so full of wisdom. I appreciate you so much.
As my wife would say, Yvonne, I pulled another one.
Well, you're
God
honest
bless.
About it. You're honest.
God bless.
And then tomorrow when I put up the podcast, I'll also tag you on the link. So if you so choose, you can share. Because, mercy, every time I talk to you, I learn more and more. And it doesn't get any better than this.
Well, Yvonne, it's wonderful for you to have me on. I hope I haven't had you on too much.
No, actually, I'm making notes to myself about how to be a better writer, how to integrate characters with plot lines, and all the things that you've told me. I'm taking them to heart because I want to be a better writer.
Yvonne, these are suggestions and opportunities. I tell most of my students, including the group now, if these in any way stand in the way of what you feel is a less inhibited expression, by all means, feel free to neglect them. It's the nurturing process of the advisory role which is important, not the content necessarily.
Well, if I had had you school, instead of some of the teachers that I had who told me that I couldn't write worth a flip, and every time I got my page back, it was redlined all the way through, I would have probably not given up my dream at a young age and then waited until I got 50 and said, screw all y'all, I'm going to do it anyway. I would have been probably published sooner or maybe even a more polished writer. So to have you in my life now, even if it's for an hour every 4 months, I am so appreciative.
Well, it's very gracious of you to have me on. I appreciate that, and I really wouldn't want it to be an imposition. If it appeals to you and you believe it appeals to your readers, I would say why not? My responsibility.
Well, it does, because the things that you impart to readers and writers and even people in general, to me, it's impactful. Everybody that listens to this show is going to take something away from this show. I guarantee it.
That is the hope. And again, I imagine somebody out at Ayers Rock all by himself, and he's receiving this. There's little else they got, but God bless the international World Wide Web. For all the damage, and God knows there is that it can do, if some of us don't hold up the torch of hope, it won't compensate in any way for the damage that's being done by others.
Exactly. So with that, my friend, I have taken up enough of your evening, and
I don't think so, Yvonne. One more. One more. You go back. But the idea of what's going on here in Washington, every president wants to be a war president, because only the war presidents are the ones that go down in history. So if you wonder what's working inside of the head of you-know-whom, that's what's going on. Okay?
Well, it's probably time for another war. Who the hell knows anymore?
It's good for everything but your Samsungs, because they're not going to be available.
Well, they've blown up anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Thanks, Yvonne. Have a good night.
You too, and I will send you a date and see if it's good with you.
Okay.
If it's not, then we'll do something else. Thank
we'll
you, my friend,
Thanks
so much.
Thanks very much indeed. Oh, you're very
good
welcome.
Night, sweetheart.
Take care now. All right, bye-bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.